This is Audible.
Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The Mistress of Magic, Book 1 of The Mists of Avalon, by Marion Zimmer Bradley. Narrated by Davina Porter. This work, copyrighted 1982 by Marion Zimmer Bradley, is recorded by arrangement with the Scott Meredith Literary Agency. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books Incorporated. A chieftain, military leader, or king named Arthur, probably of mixed British and Roman ancestry, led native forces in a series of successful campaigns against the invading Saxons, and was hero of the Great Battle of Mount Badon, circa 516 AD. These are the only things known about the historical Arthur. From this nucleus grew the mythic figure of Arthurian legend. The earliest known reference to Arthur was made 3 centuries after the famous battle by Nennius in his Historia Britonum. Nennius described Arthur as a Christian warrior, a royal general and not a king, but the oral tradition continued to embellish the legend. In 1125, William of Malmesbury complained of the proliferation of these fables, but William was one of the last chroniclers to object. For 20 years later, Geoffrey of Monmouth established Arthur's coronation and his mythical exploits as recorded history. Marion Zimmer Bradley begins her version of the legend before the birth of Arthur in a Britain abandoned by Rome to struggle alone against the invading Saxons. But among Britons there exist divisions that must be overcome if the Saxons are to be kept at bay. Between the Druidic and Christian religions, between traditional and Romanized peoples. Only a leader of mixed noble parentage, accepted by the new religion and tolerant of the old, could be recognized as High King by all the tribes and kings of Britain and unite them against the invaders, combinations requiring Druidic magic and Roman resolve. And now, the Mists of Avalon.
Prologue. Morgaine speaks. In my time, I have been called many things. Sister, lover, priestess, wise woman, queen. Now, in truth, I have come to be wise woman, and a time may come when these things may need to be known. But in sober truth, I think it is the Christians who will tell the last tale. Forever the world of faery drifts further from the world in which the Christ holds sway. I have no quarrel with the Christ, only with his priests, who call the great goddess a demon, and deny that she ever held power in this world. At best they say that her power was of Satan, or else they clothe her in the blue robe of the Lady of Nazareth, who indeed had power in her way too, and say that she was ever virgin. But what can a virgin know of the sorrows and travail of mankind? And now, when the world has changed, and Arthur, my brother, my lover, king who was, and king who shall be, lies dead, the common folk say sleeping, in the holy isle of Avalon, the tale should be told as it was before the priests of the White Christ came to cover it all with their saints and legends. For, as I say, the world itself has changed. There was a time when a traveller, if he had the will and knew only a few of the secrets, could send his barge out into the summer sea and arrive not at Glastonbury of the monks, but at the holy isle of Avalon. For at that time the gates between the worlds drifted within the mists and were open, one to another, as the traveller thought and willed. For this is the great secret which was known to all educated men in our day, that by what men think we create the world around us, daily new. And now the priests, thinking that this infringes upon the power of their God, who created the world once and for all to be unchanging, have closed those doors, which were never doors, except in the minds of men, and the pathway leads only to the priest's isle, which they have safeguarded with the sound of their church bells, driving away all thoughts of another world lying in the darkness. Indeed, they say that world, if it indeed exists, is the property of Satan, and the doorway to hell, if not hell itself. I do not know what their god may or may not have created. In spite of the tales that are told, I never knew much about their priests, and never wore the black of one of their slave nuns. If those at Arthur's court at Camelot chose to think me so when I came there, since I always wore the dark robes of the Great Mother in her guise as wise woman, I did not undeceive them. And indeed, toward the end of Arthur's reign, it would have been dangerous to do so, and I bowed my head to expediency, as my great mistress would never have done. Vivian, Lady of the Lake, once Arthur's greatest friend save for myself, and then his darkest enemy, again save for myself. But the strife is over. I could greet Arthur at last, when he lay dying, not as my enemy and the enemy of my goddess, but only as my brother, and as a dying man in need of the mother's aid, where all men come at last. Even the priests know this, with their ever-Virgin Mary in her blue robe, for she too becomes the world-mother in the hour of death. And so Arthur lay at last with his head in my lap, seeing in me neither sister nor lover nor foe, but only wise woman, priestess, Lady of the Lake, and so rested upon the breast of the Great Mother from whom he came to birth, and to whom, at last, as all men, he must go. And perhaps as I guided the barge which bore him away, not this time to the Isle of the Priests, but to the true holy isle in the dark world behind our own, that island of Avalon, where, now, few but I could go, he repented the enmity that had come between us. As I tell this tale, I will speak at times of things which befell when I was too young to understand them, or of things which befell when I was not by. And my hearer will draw away, perhaps, and say, "This is her magic." But I have always held the gift of the sight, and of looking within the minds of men and women, and in all this time I have been close to all of them. And so, at times, all that they thought was known to me in one way or another. And so I will tell this tale. For one day the priests too will tell it, as it was known to them. Perhaps between the two some glimmering of the truth may be seen. For this is the thing the priests do not know with their one God and one truth, that there is no such thing as a true tale. Truth has many faces, and a truth is like to the old road to Avalon. It depends on your own will and your own thoughts, whither the road will take you, and whether, at the end, you arrive in the holy isle of eternity, or among the priests with their bells and their death and their Satan and hell and damnation. But perhaps I am unjust even to them. Even the Lady of the Lake, who hated a priest's robe as she would have hated a poisonous viper, and with good cause too, chid me once for speaking evil of their god. "For all the gods are one god," she said to me then, as she had said many times before, and as I have said to my own novices many times, and as every priestess who comes after me will say again, "And all the goddesses are one goddess, and there is only one initiator, and to every man his own truth and the god within." And so perhaps the truth winds somewhere between the road to Glastonbury, Isle of the Priests, and the road to Avalon, lost for ever in the mists of the summer sea. But this is my truth. I, who am Morgaine, tell you these things. Morgaine, who was in later days called Morgan le Fay. Book 1. Mistress of Magic.
Chapter 1 Even in high summer, Tintagel was a haunted place. Igraine, Lady of Duke Gorlois, looked out over the sea from the headland. As she stared into the fogs and mists, she wondered how she would ever know when the night and day were of equal length, so that she could keep the feast of the new year. This year the spring storms had been unusually violent. Night and day the crash of the sea had resounded over the castle, until no man or woman within could sleep, and even the hounds whimpered mournfully. Tintagel. There were still those who believed the castle had been raised on the crags at the far end of the long causeway into the sea by the magic of the ancient folk of Ys. Duke Gorlois laughed at this, and said if he had any of their magic, he would have used it to keep the sea from encroaching year by year upon the shoreline. In the 4 years since she had come here as Gorlois' bride, Igraine had seen land, good land, crumble into the Cornish sea. Long arms of black rock, sharp and craggy, extended into the ocean from the coast. When the sun shone, it could be fair and brilliant, the sky and water as brilliant as the jewels Gorlois had heaped on her on the day when she told him she bore his first child. But Igraine had never liked wearing them. The jewel which hung now at her throat had been given her in Avalon, a moonstone which sometimes reflected the blue brilliance of sky and sea. But in the fog today, even the jewel looked shadowed. In the fog, sounds carried a long way. It seemed to Igraine, as she stood looking from the causeway back toward the mainland, that she could hear footfalls of horses and mules, and the sound of voices. Human voices, here in isolated Tintagel, where nothing lived but goats and sheep, and the herdsmen and their dogs and the ladies of the castle with a few serving women and a few old men to guard them. Slowly Igraine turned and went back towards the castle. As always, standing in its shadow, she felt dwarfed by the loom of these ancient stones at the end of the long causeway which stretched into the sea. The herdsmen believed that the castle had been built by the Ancient Ones from the lost lands of Lyonesse and Ys. On a clear day, so the fishermen said, their old castles could be seen far out under the water. But to Igraine they looked like towers of rock, ancient mountains and hills drowned by the ever-encroaching sea that nibbled away, even now, at the very crags below the castle. Here, at the end of the world, where the sea ate endlessly at the land, it was easy to believe in drowned lands to the west. There were tales of a great fire mountain which had exploded far to the south and engulfed a great land there. Igraine never knew whether she believed those tales or not. Yes, surely she could hear voices in the fog. It couldn't be savage raiders from over the sea or from the wild shores of Erin. The time was long past when she needed to startle at a strange sound or a shadow. It wasn't her husband, the Duke. He was far away to the north, fighting Saxons at the side of Ambrosius Aureolanus, High King of Britain. He would have sent word if he intended to return. And she need not fear. If the riders were hostile, the guards and soldiers in the fort at the landward end of the causeway, stationed there by Duke Gorlois to guard his wife and child, would have stopped them. It would take an army to cut through them. And who would send an army against Tintagel? There was a time, Igraine remembered without bitterness, moving slowly into the castle yard, when she would have known who rode toward her castle. The thought held little sadness now. Since Morgaine's birth, she no longer even wept for her home. And Gorlois was kind to her. He had soothed her through her early fear and hatred, had given her jewels and beautiful things, trophies of war, had surrounded her with ladies to wait upon her, and treated her always as his equal, except in councils of war. She could have asked no more, unless she had married a man of the tribes. And in this she had been given no choice.
A daughter of the Holy Isle must do as was best for her people, whether it meant going to death in sacrifice, or laying down her maidenhood in the sacred marriage, or marrying where it was thought meet to cement alliances. This Igraine had done, marrying a Romanized Duke of Cornwall, a citizen who lived, even though Rome was gone from all of Britain, in Roman fashion. She shrugged the cloak from her shoulders. Inside the court it was warmer, out of the biting wind. And there, as the fog swirled and cleared, for a moment a figure stood before her, materialized out of the fog and mist. Her half-sister, Vivian, the Lady of the Lake, the Lady of the Holy Isle. Sister? The words wavered, and Igraine knew she hadn't cried them aloud, but only whispered, her hands flying to her breast. Do I truly see you here? The face was reproachful, and the words seemed to blow away in the sound of the wind beyond the walls. Have you given up the sight, Igraine? Of your free will? Stung by the injustice of that, Igraine retorted, It was you who decreed that I must marry Gorlois. But the form of her sister had wavered into shadows, was not there, had never been there. Igraine blinked. The brief apparition was gone. She pulled the cloak around her body, for she was cold, ice cold. She knew the vision had drawn its force from the warmth and life of her own body. She thought, I didn't know I could still see in that way. I was sure I could not. And then she shivered, knowing that Father Columba would consider this the work of the devil, and she should confess it to him. True, here, at the end of the world, the priests were lax. But an unconfessed vision would surely be treated as a thing unholy. She frowned. Why should she treat a visit from her own sister as the work of the devil? Father Columba could say what he wished. Perhaps his God was wiser than he was. Which, Igraine thought, suppressing a giggle, wouldn't be very difficult. Perhaps Father Columba had become a priest of Christ because no college of druids would have had a man so stupid among their ranks. The Christ God seemed not to care whether a priest was stupid or not, so long as he could mumble their mass and read and write a little. She, Igraine herself, had more clerkly skills than Father Columba, and spoke better Latin when she wished. Igraine didn't think of herself as well educated. She hadn't had the hardihood to study the deeper wisdom of the old religion, or to go into the mysteries any further than was absolutely necessary for a daughter of the Holy Isle. Nevertheless, although she was ignorant in any temple of the mysteries, she could pass among the Romanized barbarians as a well-educated lady. In the small room, off the court, where there was sun on fine days, her younger sister, Morgause, 13 years old and budding, wearing a loose house robe of undyed wool and her old frowsy cloak about her shoulders, was spinning listlessly with a drop spindle, taking up her uneven yarn on a wobbly reel. On the floor by the fire, Morgaine was rolling an old spindle around for a ball, watching the erratic patterns the uneven cylinder made, knocking it this way and that with chubby fingers. "Haven't I done enough spinning?" Morgause complained. "My fingers ache. Why must I spin, spin, spin all the time, as if I were a waiting woman?" "Every lady must learn to spin," rebuked Igraine, as she knew she ought to do. "And your thread is a disgrace, now thick, now thin. Your fingers will lose their weariness as you accustom them to the work. Aching fingers are a sign that you've been lazy, since they are not hardened to their task." She took the reel and spindle from Morgause and twirled it with careless ease, the uneven yarn under her experienced fingers smoothed out into a thread of perfectly even thickness. Look, one could weave this yarn without snagging the shuttle. And suddenly she tired of behaving as she ought. but you may put the spindle away now. Guests will be here before mid-afternoon. Morgause stared at her. I heard nothing, she said, nor any rider with a message. That doesn't surprise me, Igraine said, for there was no rider. It was ascending. Vivian is upon her way here, and the Merlin is with her. She hadn't known that last until she said it. So you may take Morgaine to her nurse, and go and put on your holiday robe, the one dyed with saffron. Morgause put away the spindle with alacrity, but paused to stare at Igraine. My saffron gown? For my sister? Igraine corrected her sharply. Not for our sister, Morgause, but for the Lady of the Holy Isle, and for the Messenger of the Gods. Morgause looked down at the patterned floor. She was a tall, sturdy girl, just beginning to lengthen and to ripen into womanhood. Her thick hair was reddish, like Igraine's own, and there were splotches of freckles on her skin, no matter how carefully she soaked it in buttermilk and begged the herb wife for washes and simples for it. Already at 13, she was as tall as Igraine, and some day would be taller. She picked up Morgaine with an ill grace and carried her away. Igraine called after her, Tell nurse to put a holiday gown on the child, and then you may bring her down. Vivian hasn't seen her. Morgause said something ill-tempered to the effect that she didn't see why a great priestess would want to see a brat. But she said it under her breath, so that Igraine had an excuse to ignore it. Up the narrow stairs, her own chamber was cold. No fires were lighted there except in the dead of winter. While Gaulois was away, she shared the bed with her waiting woman, Gwennis, and his prolonged absence gave her an excuse to have Morgaine in her bed at night. Sometimes Morgause slept there too, sharing the fur coverlets against the bitter cold. The big marriage bed, canopied, curtained against draughts, was more than big enough for three women and a child. Gwen, who was old, was drowsing in a corner, and Igraine forbore to wake her, stripping off her workaday dress of undyed wool, and hurrying on her fine gown laced at the neck with a silk ribbon Gaulois had brought her as a fairing from Londinium. She put on her fingers some little silver rings she had had since she was a little girl. They would go only on her two smallest fingers now, and hung a necklace of amber which Gaulois had given her about her neck. The gown was dyed rust colour, and had an over-tunic of green. She found her carven horn comb, and began to pull it through her hair, sitting on a bench, and working her comb patiently through the tangles. From another room she heard a loud yelling, and decided that Morgaine was having her hair combed by her nurse, and didn't like it. The yelling stopped suddenly, and she supposed that Morgaine had been slapped into silence. Or perhaps, as sometimes happened when Morgause was in a good temper, Morgause had taken over the combing herself with her clever, patient fingers. This was how Igraine knew that her young sister could spin well enough when she chose. Her hands were so clever at everything else, at combing, at carding, at making Yule pies. Igraine braided her hair, clasped it on top of her head with a gold clasp, and put her good gold brooch into the fold of her cloak. She looked at herself in the old bronze mirror her sister Vivian had given her at her wedding, brought, they said, all the way from Rome. She knew, lacing her gown, that her breasts were once again as they had been before. Morgaine had been weaned a year now, and they were only a little softer and heavier. She knew she had her old slimness back, for she had been married in this gown, and now the laces weren't strained even a little. Gaulois, when he returned, would expect to take her to his bed again. Last time he had seen her, Morgaine had still been at the breast, and he had yielded to her plea that she might continue to suckle the child through the summer season, when so many little children died. She knew he was discontented because the baby hadn't been the son he craved,
These Romans counted their lineage through the male line rather than sensibly through the mother. It was silly, for how could any man ever know precisely who had fathered any woman's child? Of course, these Romans made a great matter of worrying over who lay with their women, and locked them up and spied on them. Not that Igraine needed watching. One man was bad enough. Who would want others who might be worse? But even though he was eager for a son, Gaulois had been indulgent, letting her have Morgaine in her bed, and continue to suckle her, even keeping away from her, and lying nights with her dressing-woman, Etar, so that she would not get with child again and lose her milk. He, too, knew how many children died if they were weaned before they could chew meat and hard bread. Children fed on gruel were sickly, and often there was no goat's milk in the summer, even if they would drink it. Children fed on cow's or mare's milk often got the vomit and died, or suffered with the flux in their bowels and died. So he had left Morgaine at her breast, thus postponing the son he wanted for at least another year and a half. For that, at least, she would always be grateful to him, and not murmur, however quickly he got her with child now. Etar had gotten herself a belly from that visit, and gone about preening herself. Would she be the one to have a son by the Duke of Cornwall? Igraine had ignored the girl. Gaulois had other bastard sons, one of whom was with him now, in the camp of the war-duke, Uther. But Etar had fallen sick and miscarried, and Igraine had enough intuition not to ask Gwen why she looked so pleased at the event. Old Gwen knew too much of herbs for Igraine's perfect peace of mind. "Some day," she resolved, "I will make her tell me exactly what she put into Etar's beer." She went down to the kitchen, her long skirts trailing on the stone steps. Morgause was there, in her finest gown, and she had put Morgaine into a holiday dress, dyed saffron, so that the child looked dark as a Pict. Igraine picked her up, holding her with pleasure. Small, dark, delicately made, so small-boned it was like handling a little soft bird. How had that child come by her looks? She herself and Morgause were tall and red-haired, earth-coloured, like all of the tribeswomen. And Gaulois, though dark, was Roman, tall and lean and aquiline, hardened from years of battle against the Saxons, too filled with his Roman dignity to show much tenderness to a young wife, and with nothing but indifference for the daughter who came in the place of the son she should have borne him. But Igraine reminded herself, these Roman men considered it their divine right to have power of life and death over their children. There were many, Christians or no, who would have demanded that a daughter not be reared, so that their wives might be free at once to give them a son. Gaulois had been good to her. He had let her keep her daughter. Perhaps, though she didn't give him credit for much imagination, he knew how she, a woman of the tribes, felt about a daughter. While she was giving orders for the entertainment of guests, for wine to be brought up from the cellars, and for the roasting of meat, not rabbit, but good mutton from the last slaughtering, she heard the squawk and flutter of frightened hens in the court, and knew that the riders had come across the causeway. The servants looked frightened, but most of them had become resigned to the knowledge that the mistress had the sight. She had pretended it, using clever guesses and a few tricks. It was just as well that they should remain in awe of her. Now she thought, maybe Vivian is right. Maybe I still have it. Maybe I only believed it was gone, because in those months before Morgaine was born, I felt so weak and powerless. Now I have come back to myself. My mother was a great priestess till the day of her death, though she bore several children. But, her mind answered her, her mother had borne those children in freedom as a tribeswoman should, to such fathers as she chose, not as a slave to some Roman whose customs gave him power over women and children. Impatiently she dismissed such thoughts. Did it matter whether she had the sight or only seemed to have it, if it kept her servants properly in order? She went slowly out to the courtyard, which Gaulois still liked to call the atrium, though it was nothing like the villa where he had lived until Ambrosius made him Duke of Cornwall. She found the riders dismounting, and her eyes went at once to the only woman among them, a woman smaller than herself, and no longer young, wearing a man's tunic and woollen breeches, and muffled in cloaks and shawls. Across the courtyard their eyes met in welcome. But Igraine went dutifully and bent before the tall, slender old man who was dismounting from a raw-boned mule. He wore the blue robes of a bard, and a harp was slung across his shoulder. "I bid you welcome to Tintagel, Lord Messenger. You bestow a blessing upon our roof, and honour it with your presence."
"I thank you, Igraine," said the resonant voice.
And Taliesin, Merlin of Britain, druid, bard, clasped his hands before his face, then extended them to Igraine in blessing. Her duty done for the instant, Igraine flew to her half-sister and would have bent for her blessing too, but Vivien bent and prevented her. "No, no, child. This is a family visit. Time enough later to do me honours, if you must." She clasped Igraine close and kissed her on the mouth. "And this is the babe. It's easy to see she has the blood of the old people. She looks like our mother, Igraine." Vivien, Lady of the Lake and of the Holy Isle, was at this time in her 30s. Eldest daughter of the ancient priestess of the lake, she had succeeded to her mother's holy office. She picked up Morgaine in her arms, dandling her with the experienced hands of a woman well accustomed to babies.
"She looks like you,"
Igraine said, surprised,
and then realizing that she should have realized this before.
But it had been 4 years since she had seen Vivien, and then at her wedding. So much had happened. She had changed so much. Since, a frightened girl of 15, she had been given into the hands of a man more than twice her age. "But come into the hall, Lord Merlin, sister. Come into the warm." Freed of her enwrapping cloaks and shawls, Vivien, Lady of Avalon, was a surprisingly little woman, no taller than a well-grown girl of 8 or 10. In her loose tunic with its wrapped belt, a knife sheathed at her waist, and bulky woollen breeches, legs wrapped with thick leggings, she looked tiny, a child put into adult clothes. Her face was small, swarthy and triangular, the forehead low beneath hair dark as the shadows beneath the crags. Her eyes were dark, too, and large in her small face. Igraine had never realized how small she was. A serving woman brought the guest cup, hot wine mixed with the last of the spices Gaulois had had sent to her from the markets in Londinium. Vivien took it between her hands, and Igraine blinked at her. With the gesture with which she took the cup, she was suddenly tall and imposing. It might have been the sacred chalice of the holy regalia. She set it between her hands and brought it slowly to her lips, murmuring a blessing. She tasted it, turned, and laid it in the hands of the Merlin. He took it with a grave bow and put it to his lips. Igraine, who had barely entered the mysteries, somehow felt that she too was part of this beautiful ritual solemnity, as in turn she took the cup from her guests, tasted it, and spoke the formal words of welcome. Then she put the cup aside, and her sense of the moment dropped away. Vivien was only a small, tired-looking woman, the Merlin no more than a stooped old man. Igraine led them both quickly to the fire. "It's a long journey from the shores of the summer sea in these days,"
she said, remembering when she had travelled it, a new-made bride, frightened and silently hating in the train of the strange husband, who, as yet, was only a voice and a terror in the night.
"What brings you here in the spring storms, my sister and my lady? And why could you not have come before? Why did you leave me all alone to learn to be a wife, to bear a child alone and in fear and homesickness? And since you could not have come before, why do you come at all when it is too late, and I am at last resigned into submission?"
"The distance is indeed long," Vivian said softly.
And Igraine knew that the priestess had heard, as she always heard, the unspoken words as well as what Igraine had said.
"And these are dangerous times, child. But you have grown into womanhood in these years, even if they have been lonely, as lonely as the years of isolation for the making of a bard, or," she added, with a flicker of a reminiscent smile, "the making of a priestess. Had you chosen that path, you would have found it equally lonely, my Igraine."
"Yes, of course," she said, reaching down, her face softening.
"You may come up on my lap, little one."
She picked up Morgaine, and Igraine watched with wonder. Morgaine was ordinarily as shy as a wild rabbit. Half resentful, half falling again under the old spell, she watched the child settle into Vivian's lap. Vivian looked almost too small to hold her securely. A fairy woman, indeed. A woman of the old people. And indeed, Morgaine would perhaps be very like her.
"And Morgawse, how has she prospered since I sent her to you a year ago?"
Vivian said,
looking up at Morgawse in her saffron gown, where she hung back resentfully in the shadows of the fire. "Come and kiss me, little sister."
"Ah,
you will be tall like Igraine," she said, raising her arms to embrace the girl, who came sullen as a half-trained puppy from the shadows.
"Yes, sit there at my knee if you want to, child."
Morgawse sat on the floor, leaning her head against Vivian's lap, and Igraine saw that the sulky eyes were filled with tears.
"She has us all in her hand. How can she have such power over us all?
Or is it that she is the only mother Morgawse has ever known?
She was a grown woman when Morgawse was born. She has always been mother as well as sister to both of us."
Their mother, who had been really too old for childbearing, had died giving birth to Morgawse. Vivian had borne a child of her own earlier in the year. Her child had died, and Vivian had taken Morgawse to nurse. Morgaine had snuggled tightly into Vivian's lap. Morgawse leaned her silky red head on Vivian's knee. The priestess held the little one with one arm, while her free hand stroked the half-grown girl's long, silky hair.
"I would have come to you when Morgaine was born," Vivian said, "but I was pregnant too. I bore a son that year. I have put him out to nurse, and I think his foster mother may send him to the monks. She's a Christian."
"Don't you mind his being reared as a Christian?" Morgawse asked. "Is he pretty? What's his name?"
Vivian laughed.
"I called him Balin," she said, "and his foster mother named her son Balin. They are only 10 days apart in age, so they will be reared as twins, no doubt. And no, I don't mind that he is reared as a Christian. His father was so, and Priscilla is a good woman." "You said the journey here was long." "Believe me, child, it is longer now than it was when you were wedded to Gaulois. Not longer, perhaps, from the Isle of the Priests where their holy thorn grows, but longer, far longer from Avalon." "And that is why we came here," said the Merlin suddenly, and his voice was like the tolling of a great bell, so that Morgaine sat up suddenly and began to whimper in fright.
"I don't understand," said Igraine, suddenly uneasy.
Surely the two lie close together.
The two are one,
said the Merlin, sitting very erect.
But the followers of Christ have chosen to say, not that they shall have no other gods before their God, but that there is no other God save for their God, that he alone made the world, that he rules it alone, that he alone made the stars and the whole of creation.
Igraine quickly made the holy sign against blasphemy. But that cannot be, she insisted. No single god can rule all things. And what of the goddess? What of the mother?
They believe, said Vivian in her smooth, low voice, that there is no goddess. For the principle of woman, so they say, is the principle of all evil. Through woman, so they say, evil entered this world. There is some fantastic Jewish tale about an apple and a snake.
The goddess will punish them, Igraine said, shaken. And yet you married me to one of them?
We did not know that their blasphemy was so all-encompassing, Merlin said. For there have been followers of other gods in our time, but they respected the gods of others.
But what has this to do with the length of the road from Avalon? Asked Igraine.
We come, then, to the reason for our visit, said the Merlin. For, as the Druids know, it is the belief of mankind which shapes the world and all of reality. Long ago, when the followers of Christ first came to our isle, I knew that this was a powerful pivot in time, a moment to change the world.
Morgause looked up at the old man, her eyes wide in awe. Are you so old, venerable one? The Merlin smiled down at the girl and said,
Not in my own body, but I have read much in the great hall, which is not in this world. There the record of all things is written. And also, I was living then. Those who are the lords of this world permitted me to come back, but in another body of flesh.
These matters are too abstruse for the little one, venerable father, Vivian said, gently rebuking him.
She is not a priestess. What the Merlin means, little sister, is that he was living when the Christians first came here, and that he chose, and was allowed, to reincarnate at once, to follow his work through. These are mysteries which you need not try to understand. Father, go on. I knew that this was one of those moments where the history of all mankind would be changed, the Merlin said. The Christians seek to blot out all wisdom save their own. And in that strife they are banishing from this world all forms of mystery save that which will fit into their religious faith. They have pronounced it a heresy that men live more than one life, which every peasant knows to be true.
But if men do not believe in more than one life, Igraine protested, shaken, how will they avoid despair? What just God would create some men wretched and others happy and prosperous if one life were all that they could have?
I do not know, said the Merlin. Perhaps they wish men to despair at the harshness of fate, so that they may come on their knees to the Christ who will take them to heaven. I do not know what the followers of Christ believe or what they hope for.
His eyes were closed for a moment, the lines of his face bitter.
But whatever it is that they believe, the views they hold are altering this world, not only in the spirit, but on the material plane. As they deny the world of the spirit and the realms of Avalon, so those realms cease to exist for them. They still exist, of course, but not in the same world with the world of the followers of Christ. Avalon, the Holy Isle, is now no longer the same island as the Glastonbury, where we of the old faith once allowed the monks to build their chapel and their monastery. For our wisdom and their wisdom. How much do you know of natural philosophy, Igraine?
Very little, said the young woman, shaken, looking at the priestess and the great druid. I have never been taught.
A pity, said the Merlin, for you must understand this, Igraine. I will try to make it simple for you. Look you, he said, and took the gold torch from his throat, then drew his dagger. Can I put this bronze and this gold into the same place at once?
She blinked and stared, not understanding. No, of course not.
They can be side by side, but not in the same place unless you move one of them first. And so it is with the Holy Isle, said Merlin. The priests swore an oath to us 400s of years ago, before even the Romans came here and tried to conquer, that they would never rise against us and drive us forth with weapons. For we were here before them, and then they were suppliants and weak. And they have honoured that oath. So much I must give to them. But in spirit, in their prayers, they have never ceased to strive with us for their God to drive away our gods, their wisdom to rule over our wisdom. In our world, Igraine, there is room enough for many gods and many goddesses. But in the universe of the Christians, how can I say this? There is no room for our vision or our wisdom. In their world, there is one God alone. Not only must he conquer over all gods, he must make it as if there were no other gods, had never been any gods, but only false idols, the work of their devil. So that, believing in him, all men may be saved in this one life. This is what they believe. And as men believe, so their world goes. And so the worlds which once were one are drifting apart. There are now two Britons, Igraine, their world under their one God and the Christ, and beside it, and behind it, the world where the Great Mother still rules, the world where the old people have chosen to live and worship. This has happened before. There was the time when the fairy folk, the shining ones, withdrew from our world, going further and further into the mists, so that only an occasional wanderer can now spend a night within the elf mounds. And if he should do so, time drifts on without him, and he may come out after a single night and find that his kinfolk are all dead, and that a dozen years have gone by. And now, I tell you, Igraine, it is happening again. Our world, ruled by the goddess and the horned one, her consort, the world you know, the world of many truths, is being forced away from the mainstream course of time. Even now, Igraine, if a traveller sets out with no guide for the Isle of Avalon, unless he know the way very well, he cannot come there, but will find only the Isle of the Priests. To most men, our world is now lost in the mists of the summer sea. Even before the Romans left us, this was beginning to happen. Now, as churches cover the whole of Britain, our world grows further and further away. That is why it took us so long to come here. Fewer and fewer of the cities and roads of the old people remain for our guide. The worlds still touch, still lie upon one another, close as lovers. But they are drifting apart. And if they are not stopped, one day there will be two worlds, and none can come and go between the two.
Let them go, interrupted Vivian angrily. I still think we should let them go. I do not want to live in a world of Christians who deny the Mother.
But what of all the others? What of those who will live in despair?
The Merlin's voice was like a great soft bell again.
No, a pathway must remain, even if it is secret. Parts of the world are still one. The Saxons raid in both worlds, but more and more of our warriors are followers of Christ. The Saxons are barbarians and cruel,
said Vivian. The tribes alone cannot drive them from these shores. And the Merlin and I have seen that Ambrosius is not long for this world, and that his war-duke, the Pendragon, is it Uther they call him, will succeed him. But there are many in this country who will not rally to the Pendragon. Whatever may befall our world in the spirit, neither of our worlds can long survive the fire and sword of the Saxons. Before we can fight the spiritual battle, which will keep the worlds from moving further apart, we must save the very heart of Britain from being ravaged by Saxon fires. Not only the Saxons assault us, but Jutes, Scots, all the wild folk who are moving down from the north. Every place, even Rome itself, is being overpowered. There are so many of them. Your husband has been fighting all his life. Ambrosius, Duke of Britain, is a good man, but he can command loyalty only from those who once followed Rome. His father wore the purple, and Ambrosius, too, was ambitious to be emperor. But we must have a leader who will appeal to all the folk of Britain. But Rome remains, Igraine protested. Gaulois told me that when Rome had overcome her troubles in the great city, the legions would return. Can we not look to Rome for help against the wild folk from the north? The Romans were the greatest fighters of the world. They built the Great Wall to the north to hold back the wild raiders. Merlin's voice took on the empty sound that was like the tolling of a great bell.
I have seen it in the Holy Well, he said. The eagle has flown, and shall never return to Britain.
Rome can do nothing, Vivian said. We must have our own leader, one who can command all of Britain. Otherwise, when they mass against us, all Britain will fall, and for hundreds and hundreds of years we will lie in ruins beneath the Saxon barbarians. The worlds will drift irrevocably apart, and the memory of Avalon will not remain even in legend to give hope to mankind. No, we must have a leader who can command loyalty from all the people of both the Britons. The Britain of the priests and the world of the mists ruled from Avalon. Healed by this great king, her voice took on the clear mystical ring of prophecy. The world shall once again come together, a world with room for the goddess and for the Christ, the cauldron and the cross. And this leader shall make us one.
But where shall we find such a king? Igraine asked. Who shall give us such a leader?
And then, suddenly, she was afraid. Felt ice pouring down her back as the Merlin and the priestess turned to look at her, their eyes seeming to hold her motionless as a small bird under the shadow of a great hawk. And she understood why the messenger prophet of the Druids was called the Merlin. But when Vivian spoke, her voice was very soft. She said, "You, Igraine, you shall bear this great king." Chapter 2 There was silence in the room, except for the small crackle of the fire. At last Igraine heard herself draw a long breath, as if she had just wakened from sleep.
"What is this that you are telling me? Do you mean that Gaulois is to be the father of this great king?"
She heard the words echoing in her mind and ringing there, and wondered why she had never suspected Gaulois of so great a destiny. She saw her sister and the Merlin exchange glances, and saw, too, the small gesture with which the priestess silenced the old man.
"No, Lord Merlin, a woman must say this to a woman."
"Igraine, Gaulois is Roman. The tribes will not follow any man born to a son of Rome. The High King they follow must be a child of the Holy Isle, a true son of the goddess. Your son, Igraine, yes. But it isn't the tribes alone that will fight away the Saxons and the other wild folk from the north. we will need the support of Romans and Celts and Cymri, and they will follow only their own war duke. There, Pendragon, son of a man they trust to lead them and rule, and the old people, too, who seek the son of a royal mother. Your son, Igraine. But the father will be Uther, Pendragon.
Igraine stared at them, understanding, until rage slowly broke through against the numbness.
Then she flared at them. No, I have a husband, and I have borne him a child. I will not let you play again at skipping stones with my life. I married as you bade me, and you will never know.
The words choked in her throat. There would never be any way to tell them of that first year. Even Vivian would never know. She could say, I was afraid. Or, I was alone and terrified. Or, rape would have been easier because I could have run away to die afterward. But any of those would have been only words, conveying only the smallest part of what she had felt. And even if Vivian had known the whole, touching her mind and knowing all that she could not say, Vivian would have looked on her with compassion and even a little pity, but wouldn't have changed her mind or demanded even a little less from Igraine. She had heard her sister say it often enough when Vivian still believed Igraine would become priestess of the mysteries. If you seek to avoid your fate or to delay suffering, it only condemns you to suffer it redoubled in another life. So she didn't say any of those things, only glared at Vivian with the stifled resentment of the last 4 years, when she had done her duty valiantly and alone, submitting to her fate with no more outcry than any woman was allowed to make. But again? Never, Igraine told herself silently. Never. She shook her head stubbornly.
Listen to me, Igraine, said the Merlin. I fathered you, though that gives me no rights. It is the blood of the lady which confers royalty, and you are of the oldest royal blood, descended from daughter to daughter of the Holy Isle. It is written in the stars, child, that only a king who comes of two royalties, one royalty of the tribes who follow the goddess, and one royalty of those who look to Rome, will heal our land of all this strife. A peace must come when these two lands can dwell side by side. A peace long enough for the cross and the cauldron, too, to come to such a peace. If there is such a reign as this, Igraine, even those who follow the cross will have the knowledge of the mysteries to comfort them in their bleak lives of suffering and sin, and their belief in one brief life to choose forever between hell or heaven for all eternity. Otherwise, our world will fade into the mists, and there will be hundreds of years, thousands perhaps, where the goddess and the holy mysteries will be forgotten by all mankind, except those few who can come and go between the worlds. Would you let the goddess and her work fade from this world, Igraine? You, who were born of the Lady of the Holy Isle, and the Merlin of Britain.
Igraine bent her head, barricading her mind against the tenderness in the old man's voice. She had always known, without being told, that Taliesin, Merlin of Britain, had shared with her mother the spark of life which had made her. But a daughter of the Holy Isle didn't speak of such things. A daughter of the lady belonged only to the goddess, and to that man into whose hands the lady chose to give its care. Most often her brother, only very rarely the man who had begotten it. There was a reason for this. No pious man should claim fatherhood to a child of the goddess, and all children born to the lady were considered so. Taliesin should use this argument now, shocked her deeply. But it touched her, too.
Yet, she said stubbornly, refusing to look at him,
Gorlois might have been chosen Pendragon. Surely this Uther cannot be so much beyond all sons of